Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, heroes, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is the first episode of a new season. We have finally finished up Babylonian mythology, and we are moving on to the topic decided by your votes, and that is Japanese mythology. This won out over Egyptian mythology by one vote. So, I'm guessing that that may mean that our next season is Egyptian, but we'll see how it goes. Now, a word of caution here at the beginning. As I said before with some of our other seasons, I'm not an expert on Japanese mythology and Japanese religion, and I want to be particularly cautious because, unlike some of the pantheons that we have talked about, you know, this is not a historical religion. Well, it is a historical religion, but it is also a contemporary religion, right? This is a living system of belief and of worship. A lot more people in the world who practice Shinto than who worship Anu or Marduk. Not that there aren't any, but you know what I mean. There's a lot of information available out there, and, you know, me with my copy of the Oxford Dictionary of World Religions and, you know, the other sources that I, as a layman and as someone who doesn't read Japanese, have access to, like, I don't want to suggest that I'm presenting a definitive account of any of these myths. Additionally, I mentioned a moment ago, I don't speak Japanese, so if my pronunciation is off, I mean, I've done my best here, but I'm sure that there are some mistakes. I'm particularly conscious of these limitations because we've seen in previous seasons that when it comes to religions outside the Western mainstream, deities and demigods is not always super amazing. And we've seen a very mixed picture in its presentation, for example, of Chinese religion. As it happens, the introduction to Japanese mythology that's presented here is not bad. It identifies some of the key features of a Japanese-style religion in a game world, and not other ones. So perhaps we would say that the introduction is somewhat cursory, but it doesn't seem to contain a lot of obviously incorrect information. So I guess that's something. However, there is the issue of this gee whiz old-timey Chinese restaurant font at the head of the page. That's not cool. You know, let's not do that in this day and age. Obviously, this book is not from this day and age, but I think we could not let it pass without pointing it out. So we begin with an overall discussion of Shinto, which introduces the idea of the kami. Now, kami is a category of supernatural forces or supernatural beings that permeate the world, and you might say that they are gods, or you might say that they are spirits. Some people don't even like to translate the word kami because it does not map neatly onto any one of those religious concepts. It's a broader category of supernatural or numinous beings that includes some figures that we would recognize as sort of gods in the sense of like Zeus or Odin, and some other figures which are much more kind of what we would think of as spirits. But all within a broader category of kami within the Shinto cosmology, the Shinto view of the universe. They are part of nature, and many, indeed most of them, are present here in the world that we live in. The existence of and relationship with kami is central to Shinto. Shinto is a collection of ritual and ceremonial practices, shrines and their traditions. It is not exactly... The fact of the matter is that most of us who come from a kind of Western cultural background, even if we are not ourselves Christians, our idea of what a religion is shaped by Christianity, and to a lesser extent, by Judaism and Islam. But the truth is that many, if not most, religions don't fit very neatly into that category. And indeed, some religions have been kind of shaved and squeezed a bit to fit them into that, right? I mean, these are ideas of religion that are active in the world and that have been influential on other faiths. The same is true of Shinto, where there is this movement to organize it and turn it into a single thing, comparatively recently in Japanese history, which is no more than to point out that religions change and develop over time, and one of the things that changes them is their contact with people's conceptions of what religion ought to be. I got sidetracked. My point is that some features that you would anticipate in a religion, you're not going to find in Shinto. So, for example, many people who practice Shinto will also take part in Buddhist religious practices, and they just don't see the two as being incompatible. Even though, if we were like going through the big library of religions, we would think of Buddhism and Shinto as two different religions. But rather than having strict boundaries, we ought to think of these as overlapping spiritual practices. To give you an example, I mentioned before, you know, James sitting with his notebook and his copy of the Oxford Dictionary of World Religions. Well, the Oxford Dictionary of World Religions says, and I quote, that Shinto has no founder, no official sacred scriptures, and no fixed system of doctrine. It does have collections of mythology, which begin to emerge in around the 8th century. They date the beginning of Shinto to sometime around the 6th century CE. But over the centuries, it's been influenced by its contact with other religious and spiritual traditions, most notably Buddhism. One of the first things in this section is a description of a Shinto shrine. But this is important because Shinto is a religion of participatory ritual focused on these shrines and focused on the world that we inhabit. There are a variety of different types of Shinto. This is the only thing I know about Shinto because when I was an undergraduate, which is now more than 20 years ago, but when I was an undergraduate, I started writing an undergraduate thesis on educational reform in post-World War II Japan and about the work of a woman named Elizabeth Vining Davis, who was the personal tutor to then Crown Prince Akihito. In the end, I didn't end up writing it, which was in fact one of the things that kind of most changed my life because I didn't write it, I had to take an extra subject. I could trade one of my papers for writing this thesis, and the paper that I took instead of writing the thesis was the Vikings paper, and I would have taken a modern paper, but they were all full by the time I decided to change. So in fact, I wound up being an early medievalist because I couldn't really make any headway with this educational reform in post-war Japan thing. I didn't feel like I had anything new to say about it. But one of the issues that most troubled the people guiding this reform, who were, of course, like the occupying Americans, was the issue of religious reform, because one of the many types of Shintoism was specifically associated with the veneration of the imperial family and the central authority of the state and of the military. What we think of when we think of Shinto, that's I think what is typically called shrine Shinto, which is a term for the religious practices of the many different Shinto shrines that you find all in Japanese communities and all around the Japanese landscape. There's folk Shinto, kind of your daily rituals of average believers. And then you have sect Shinto, which refers to different, like, specific sects within a broader Shinto system of belief, these sects being more or less esoteric. And then we have the thing that got more or less eliminated, which was state Shinto, the central state control of certain aspects of Shinto belief. All of this is pretty much to say that centralized religions with official teachings are really the exception. Shinto is, you know, a bit distributed and not standardized, which is more like what most religions are really like. And it's an ideal religion for fantasy adventuring. Spirits are present in the world, there are lots of folk festivals and things to participate in, shrines tend to be largely independent of each other, sort of transactional, or, well, transactional is the wrong word, but practical relationships between humans and kami are important to the way that the religion thinks, and there isn't too much clerical hierarchy. All promising qualities for a religion to inspire a religion in a fantasy RPG. Like with the other pantheon sections, we begin with what the book considers to be the deity at the head of the pantheon, the 400 hit point character. And this is Amaterasu o Mikami, translates as something like heaven illuminating great deity or heavenly shining deity, essentially a sun goddess. She is identified in Deities and Demigods here as the mother of the pantheon, which is, she is certainly the mother of many of the deities in the pantheon. These 8th century collections of sort of history, you know, legendary history and mythology, the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki, they contain multiple different versions of these stories. They're similar to each other, but they differ in some respect. So I'm kind of trying to go toward the middle of these accounts, but important to remember that they actually do vary. So she's the child of the kind of foundational deities, Izanagi and Izanami, and she is given the assignment of
a ruler of heaven. We can envision Shinto cosmology as being divided into sort of three bands. You've got the heavens, the earth, and the underworld. So she's one of Izanagi's three precious children, together with Tsukuyomi, who's the moon. So Amaterasu is the sun, and her brother Susanoo, the storm god. One of the accounts in Nihon Shoki says that she was immediately granted this sovereignty over heaven because of her exceptional qualities. There were a couple of things that I thought were interestingly missing from Amaterasu's entry in Deities and Demigods, which is very short and describes things like, oh, she shines, which, okay, yes, she does. Sun goddesses tend to do that. But her rivalry with her brother is not mentioned at all. And that seems like an oversight. Maybe it'll be in his entry, because he's obviously in here somewhere. But it seems to me to be pretty important. Susanoo, the storm god, is an unruly character, and eventually Izanagi kicks him out. He goes to say farewell to Amaterasu, and then there's like an exchange of children, deities. That bit appears to have some symbolic significance that I don't fully understand, but his rages disrupt heaven, and there's a couple of different accounts of what exactly he does that is so bad that Amaterasu decides to like flee him and go live in a cave. But the least violent, the one that doesn't involve any animal cruelty, is that he goes to the bathroom under her throne. So, you know, we're already building up a picture of him as this unruly character who defies the laws of politeness and civility, but also, like, people get hurt during his rages. So she locks herself away in this cave, but of course, because the sun has gone into the cave, the universe is now plunged into darkness. So the other deities decide that they're going to trick her into coming out. They hold this celebration, saying that they're celebrating the arrival of a new deity, and Amaterasu hears them having this, you know, this party and all cheering and being happy, and thinks, you know, what could be going on. She asks them what's happening, and they tell her. And so she rolls back partly this stone that she's got at the mouth of the cave, and she creeps out a little bit to see what's happening. And they hold up a mirror toward her, and mirrors being a sacred symbol particularly associated with Amaterasu, and this is sort of why. And seeing the brightness of her own reflection, she thinks, oh, that must be this wonderful god. She goes a little bit more toward it, and wham, they pounce. And, you know, they block up the cave so she can't go back inside. All is well again, unless you happen to be Susanoo, who gets kicked out of heaven. I don't want to go too much into his adventures, because obviously we'll get to his entry later on, but on one of his adventures down on Earth, which is where he goes to, he gets a legendary sword, and I'm astonished that this, you know, maybe the most famous legendary sword in world literature, Grass Cutter, is not, how is it not in this section? This is a game where magic swords are the meat and drink of Dungeons and Dragons, and it's not here. It's not in the traditional kind of magic item section at the beginning of the Pantheon. It's not there. Maybe it's later on in the section. I kind of go through these things in real time. Like, I haven't read to the end of this bit yet. So maybe we'll run into it later on. Maybe it's in, Oriental Adventures. And that's why it's not here. That's a possibility. I don't know. Anyway, he gets this legendary, marvelous sword and gives it to her as a sign of contrition. And she will then later bestow it on her grandson. This is kind of cool, too. From heaven, Amaterasu looks on Earth and sees it in this chaotic state and thinks, this is no good, and sends a series of gods down to subdue it. And, you know, one by one, they kind of duff it up and don't do a great job. Finally, she sends another deity down to take care of it, and then sends down her grandson, a god called Ninigi, to rule Earth following its conquest, and he becomes the ancestor of the emperors. And he gets the sword, right? He's the grandson she gives the sword to, along with some other treasures, which are also not in here. And the gods of his retinue become the ancestors of these sort of ceremonially important noble clans in Japanese history. So this conquest of Earth by heaven, which is portrayed as a restoring of beneficial order, is the justification for imperial sovereignty. Again, something that we've seen before, right? This is a little bit like the way that Marduk works, right? Marduk's sovereignty over heaven is directly tied to the idea of Babylonian imperialism. Divine justifications for ruling families, not exactly a new concept here. But I think that if you're going to draw inspiration from Amaterasu in a fantasy pantheon, there's a lot of good stuff here. The drive to subdue the Earth and render it, you know, civilized, essentially. The feud with a rival god who is nonetheless still basically okay, right? Susanoo is a rival, not an enemy. That's really good. Rivalries between the gods are a good thing. The period of darkness where the sun deity is locked away. Again, as a Gloranthophile, it's hard for me not to see this as having inspired the myth of the death of Yelm, the sun god in Glorantha. While I was reading about this myth, I encountered a thing that suggested that Amaterasu being in the cave and like being brought out by her children and relatives and whatever was a metaphor for recovering from depression. Now, I haven't talked a lot about my struggles with my mental health on this show, and I'm not going to, but I will say that as someone who has dealt with depression in the past and probably will again in the future, if I ever retire to a, you know, dark enclosed space to like be moody and be by myself, I'm sure I would appreciate people trying to get me out of it, but maybe not by throwing a party and claiming that a better James has come along. I feel like I would not take it in the same spirit of curiosity that Amaterasu did. What works for the ruler of the gods may not necessarily work for everyone else. Just a warning there. I'm not sure that these heavenly deities are qualified mental health professionals. Now, a while ago, listener Albert, whose displeasure with my understanding and pronunciation I am constantly anticipating, suggested that you could interpret, not that this is what these myths actually mean, but that if you were using them as creative inspiration, you could interpret them in this way, that the rivalry as portrayed between Susanoo and Amaterasu, this idea of a rowdy, undignified storm god in an otherwise tranquil heaven, is the nicified version of the conflict created by the victorious sun faction in the fight. And that you can look at a lot of this mythology as expressive of a conflict between the sun and storm, between, you know, law and chaos. And even look at the different lineages of gods as belonging to sun and storm factions. Because, like I said earlier, there's this exchange of deities where Amaterasu creates some deities, but then they go with Susanoo. I'm not sure what that's all about. I may have misunderstood that. I wouldn't quote me, but that's not something Albert said. That's me. And that you can incorporate some of these gods into that framework, revealing a conflict within a pantheon that is presented as having resolved all of its conflicts. And that is one of the things, you know, mythology and game writing have this big difference, which is that a lot of mythologies don't have a present conflict in them. Norse mythology, I think one of the reasons people like it is because there is a future conflict, although then they go and ruin it by predetermining the outcome of that conflict. But in general, mythologies tend to place all of their conflict in the backstory. The exciting stuff about Marduk is his conflict with Tiamat, but that already happened. But if you assume that these myths are spin from the victorious side, then you can say, well, maybe that conflict between a serene and harmonious rulership and a rowdy butt kicker is still ongoing. And that represents a conflict that can be both an internal conflict within a person or a political conflict between factions within a group. Susanoo is the player character god, right? Like, he plays dirty jokes on people and gets into fights and fights monsters. Like, specifically some monster-slaying hero who's also, you know, a rowdy jerk. I think a lot of player characters look at that guy and go, he's pretty cool. And then look at Amaterasu and go, oh, so imperial authority is as natural as the sun in the sky, is it? If you want to make the law and peace and happiness faction within that conflict more interesting, you have to imperil them, right? You can't just always have them be right. You can't just always have them win. And so putting that conflict in gives you an opportunity for, you know, your Wolverine players to go around doing Wolverine things. But it also finally gives your Cyclops players an opportunity to do Cyclops things. Because a lot of the time, you know, everyone who grew up watching the X-Men cartoon from the 90s thinks of Cyclops as nothing but a boring killjoy. But most of the time he is right. And you can redeem him from being a boring killjoy by actually having stakes and threatening that status quo. I don't know. I guess what I mean to say is boring Killjoys fighting on behalf of the side that's already won just seem like oppressors. Boring Killjoys trying to establish a space of peace and order so that people can live their lives and be safe are maybe a necessary thing. But in order to take those mythologies and turn them into something gameable, you have to take those conflicts and foreground them, because otherwise you have player characters whose main thing is that, you know, the clerics and paladins are defenders of the status quo, and that's boring. If you have an unacceptable status quo for both sides, that's interesting. Okay, that's about all the time that we have for today, and that was our first episode on Japanese mythology. I've got a lot of reading to do. I got a lot of references stacked up here, and hopefully I'm going to be able to add a little bit more depth to my understanding here. But I'm learning as I go, too. This is a learning experience for me, and I think that's part of the fun of it. So I hope that you will join me next time as we delve further into the Japanese pantheon and take a look at some more deities. All that here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.